This is episode 107 of the Prepper Website Podcast. Today's articles are 4 T's of Emergency Communications Planning, Is This the Generation That Is Going to Financially Destroy America?, and Snake Bites in Austere Settings. Hey, I'm Todd Sepulveda, the editor of PrepperWebsite.com. This podcast is an audible version with some commentary of articles that have been posted on Prepper Website, a daily aggregator of preparedness information. These articles are some of the best of the best that have been recently posted on PrepperWebsite.com. All article links and show information can be found on the PrepperWebsitePodcast.com. Hey, yesterday I talked briefly about Suspicious Observer when we were talking about the solar, I guess the CME, and then the fires that would cause. Earlier today, there was, I posted on the Facebook group, the Prepper Website Facebook group. You can get to that on the linking to it from the Prepper Website Podcast, or just go to amoreselfreliantlife.com, and then it'll take you straight there. But, I saw that there was some other activity, and so I decided to go ahead and post that. I took like a screenshot off my phone and posted it on the Facebook group. And then a little bit later on, I noticed that there was a big earthquake with a tsunami warning in Russia, and it was right after the I was on Twitter and saw RT.com, one of their Twitter posts, and it said here the quake comes shortly after a powerful spewing of ash from the Klukovsky volcano in Kamchatka. The ash plume rose to a height of 6 kilometers above sea level, prompting an advisory of planes flying in the region, local media reported. So there was that volcano kind of went off, and then that 7.7 earthquake off the coast of Russia that wind up giving a little tsunami warning. And then you had aftershocks of 5.1, 5.2, 5.3. I mean, that's still an earthquake, right? You know, 5.3, that's still an earthquake, a decent earthquake. But they're just, you can see them on earthquake.usgs.gov, and they're just kind of just blowing up all over the place. And then right before I got ready to start recording, there was a 6.4 in Peru. So all over the ring of fire, you know, going on. Alaska has had some really small ones here, 3.1. I'll keep this up while I'm recording and come back to it a little bit later on and see if anything else has transpired throughout the evening while I'm recording. Hey, tonight is the night. So if you are listening to this on Tuesday, this is the Tuesday podcast. This evening is the webinar with Paul of Son of an International. So hopefully you get a chance to be a part of that and to come hang out with us and listen. I did post some pictures on Facebook of the Son Oven that I have, and let me tell you, it's a sturdy piece of equipment. And so, looking forward to actually, you know, someone on the Facebook group or Facebook asked me, you know, when am I getting it dirty? And looking forward to doing that and seeing, you know, maybe doing some meat in it, and you know, going that way, knowing that it, you know, it won't dry out. So. Looking forward to taking care of that. But hopefully you can come be a part of that webinar. You can come over to the PrepperWebsitePodcast.com and link to the registration page. And even up until like an hour out, you're still good. You'll get an email getting ready. You know, there'll be an email sent out to you to that you can come be a part of the webinar. And then hang out with us and all that good stuff. So looking forward to that. So that'll be 7 o'clock Central Time on Tuesday, July 18th, just in case you're listening to this at a later date. All right, so let's go ahead and get moving on these articles. We do have some good articles today. Like always, I try to pick the best for you. This one comes to us, our first one comes to us from TalonSurvival.com. And it's 4 T's of Emergency Communications Planning. I think it's an important topic, and so we're going to talk about some things here and move forward. All right, so 4 elements of communications need to be considered when you are developing your emergency communications plan. The 4 T's of communications can be the difference between getting the message out when it matters most or being in a black hole with no way to communicate with friends or loved ones. be sure to account for the four T's when you decide how you plan to communicate with your family in an emergency. The impacts on communications infrastructures varies based on the type of disaster you are faced with. Every type of occurrence or disaster has a different set of impacts. Although there are a number of potential impacts which can hinder communications, there are three major ones to look out for as you develop your emergency communications plan: geographical size, physical damage to infrastructure, and power availability. Each one of these substantial impacts is a trigger point. The greater they are, the more substantial your communications challenge will be. As your impact area gets bigger, the harder it will be to reach outside of the impact zone. For example, to get the high-speed data and voice on your cell phone we are familiar with in today's age, you typically have to be within a few miles of a cellular tower. As the geographical impact area increases beyond this range, the more difficult it becomes for your cellular device to obtain a signal. In some cases, you may lose it altogether. Once your signal is completely gone, you will have to divert to a secondary communication means that can bridge this distance gap. In this situation, you may be able to temporarily move outside the impact area to make your emergency contacts, but again, as the impact area grows, this also becomes unfeasible. When antennas, antenna towers, and internet backbones that support your existing communication infrastructure gets damaged, you exponentiate the amount of time that it will take to bring it back to normal. As your infrastructure goes down due to damage, regardless of the type, cellular, two-way radio, over repeaters, etc., it instantly causes an increase in congestion on the surrounding systems that are still online. The communications volume increases not only because you are now in a disaster and everyone is trying to communicate, but also because the communications towers that are still online are now handling additional traffic from the downed towers as well. Let's quickly look at a physical example. You can probably hold 2 to 3 tennis balls in one hand comfortably. If you can hold 4, no need to brag, but good for you. So place 2 or 3 tennis balls or whatever you can hold in each hand. Now, one of your hands gets damaged, and now you can no longer use it. So hand over all the tennis balls in that hand to the other undamaged hand. What happens? Tennis balls will fall. So why does this occur? Because your working hand has a certain capacity, and you are now trying to push it beyond that capacity. Once its capacity is maxed out, the remaining balls fall. This is the exact same thing that happens with communications infrastructure. The towers that are still online are pushed beyond their capacity, so some communications drop out. When the power infrastructure is damaged, some systems in the impact area that allow you to communicate via your normal methods will go down immediately, or more commonly, they are instantly put on a countdown clock. Why the clock? Because they are now on generator power or a battery. Each of these power sources must be replenished to keep the system online. If this fuel source is not maintained or refilled, the system goes offline. The longer the time period without power, the greater the risk of the backup power source failing. In addition, the larger the area where the power infrastructure is impacted, the longer it will take to turn it back on. As you can see, each one of these trigger points can substantially increase the time that the standard communication systems will be down, therefore increasing the amount of time you will have to utilize your emergency communications method. How long are you going to have to utilize your emergency communications methods for the disaster? Will it be 2 hours? Will it be 2 days? Will it be 2 weeks or 2 months? The longer the amount of time you are without your normal communications means, the more likely you will have to move to your alternate communication method in your emergency communication plan. If you have an outage that will be limited to a few hours, you may not even worry about alternate means of communications, or the adaptations to bridge the communication issue will be relatively simple in nature, like sending an email or text instead of a phone call. As these outages times increase due to system damage or other impacts as described above, the means of communications adaptations becomes more limited and more complex. This is why training on your communication method are important for yourself and your family. We will discuss in more detail below. Just as you are told to diversify investment portfolios and don't put all your eggs in one basket, the same is true with the types of communication systems you plan to use as part of your emergency communication plan. You do not want to depend on one type of communication technology entirely for your emergency communications. You should diversify. For example, instead of depending solely on cell phones, add in two-way radios into the mix or satellite communicator device. There are endless options available, especially if you are an amateur radio operator. We will talk more about types of communication methods and what is available in future articles. Develop your diversified communication plan based on the communication systems you have available to you. Once you know your available communication methods, prioritize them starting by the ones you and your family use the most. Why start with what you use the most? Because you train on those methods the most often and you are the most proficient in them. This allows you to communicate faster when the seconds count. For the majority of people, they will start with their cell phones, including cellular voice call, cellular data, and SMS messaging. These methods are a core starting point, assuming you use cell phones quite often, as they inherently touch each continuity option available via the cellular technology. From there, focus on the backup methods you have available and use the most. For example, if you have family radio service or FRS radios that you use with your friends and family when you go out camping or hunting, this may be your runner-up. They are more for short-range communications, but your family is more proficient with them due to your use during activities and outings. Another example expanding what we discussed above is social media. If you have a data connection to the internet, social media allows you to communicate effectively with family and friends. The information also remains posted even if you go offline, which is helpful when communication systems are intermittent. However, you must consider the impacts on your personal security, or PERSEC. Never heard that one before. If you use this as a communication means, social media is not private. Some social media systems, such as Facebook, allow you to limit who sees your information, but you must stay on top of your security settings for your account and also for each post. The wrong flick of the thumb with posting information, and it can be placed in the public view. Once information is in the open, it can and will be cached or saved by others. This information is no longer secure, and in an emergency situation can open you up for vulnerabilities. The friends of friends settings in a survival situation should also be considered unsecure. Can you vouch for the trust everyone your friends know? Furthermore, do you trust your family's livelihood to the convictions of all the friends of the friends? For example, you tell your family via a social media post that you're leaving your home and headed out of town to evacuate, as you have no power in hot weather. Your social media settings are set to friends of friends, or worst off, public. You have now shared with a plethora of people that your home is vacant, not to mention many of them who also probably don't have power and may be in worse situations than you. A 2011 survey by Credit Sesame found that 78% of burglars used Facebook, Twitter, and Foursquare to target potential properties, and now your home is a known unguarded target for others who need or want your stuff. All right, so just really quick on this. He's going to talk about Twitter here just in a minute. Facebook, yeah, you probably don't want to put a big old post, you know, make it live. But there are a couple of options. I mean, you have direct messenger, right? If you have your phone, you can download the messenger app for Facebook and directly message your family that way. If that's all you have, and that's something. But more than likely, if you have Facebook, you're going to have, you know, text messaging and all that kind of stuff. One of the other things that you can do is put all your family, you know, maybe not just your immediate family, but like your extended family, you know, cousins and uncles and those kinds of things. You know, if you feel you can trust them, and just let them know, hey, this is a family group. It's only going to be for family. We're only going to share things for the family. We're not going to post, you know, anything else out there on Facebook. And so you can make a group. So just like I made the Prepper website Facebook group, and you have to you have to ask for permission to join. The same thing is true for a family. You can make your own family Facebook group that you want to share things out, and only people that are allowed in that group will be able to see it. You can make a secret group where you can't find it at all. You can make a closed group to where people can see, and that's what the Facebook group, the Prepper website Facebook group is. It's a closed group, so people can see who are members in there, but you can't see the actual post until you become a member. So those are two options there. He's going to talk about some other ones here. As for Twitter, we do not recommend as an emergency communications method. Consider it public, enough said. Overall, we recommend you stay away from social media if possible for emergency communications due to the personal security risk. Again, on Twitter, you can do direct messages as well. Consider an email alert group using Yahoo Groups, Google Groups, or other means instead. They are a little old school and take a little more time to set up, but allow you a free closed group to only members you vet for entry. They also tend to be more hands-off as they send you an email for a new post so you don't have to log in to get the latest notifications. The information is still stored online so you can see all the posts when you do access via the web, but you aren't required to do so, as you can read the email strings in your inbox instead. Pictures and images can be included in posts as well. The age of the people you are communicating with may play a great role in determining your communications method you use. If you are predominantly communicating with the older and wiser generation, you may consider limiting your cellular capabilities or completely alleviate social media altogether. If you plan to still include these items, you may need to provide additional training on the technology. As for younger generations, it can be the opposite. For the youngsters, you will most likely need to stress the importance of limiting social media communications or restricting them altogether due to the vulnerabilities they bring to the family. Many children and young adults from grade school to college do not understand the security vulnerabilities and risk associated with social media today. Once you have trained the types of communications you plan to use, the most important factor is practicing the use of these methods and executing your emergency communication plan. Test your primary communication method weekly at the least. Remember, for most, this is sending a text, email, and phone call. Test your secondary communication system monthly. This may be sending an email to your emergency communications Yahoo group or testing the range of your two-way radio. Remember to use the same methods and procedures you plan to use during times of emergency. You can only fight the way you practice. If you have children, they can be a great asset in your communication testing and help you out. Make it fun for them to help. Turn your range testing of your two-way radios into a game. As you test your range, turn it into a game of I Spy, looking for long-range items such as airplanes, birds, cars, or even clouds of a particular shape. Let them take it to their friends out when they go over to play. Use this as your method of communicating with them while they are there in place of a cell phone. Let them use the radios with their friends during a sleepover or a camping trip so they become more proficient in the use of the equipment. Remember, you aren't the only one communicating. Usually, you want information communicated in return. Train the people you plan to communicate with. Get them engaged in the testing process. For secondary communications methods, there aren't used as often. A how-to guide or a checklist may be helpful. May be a helpful tool when you need it the most. You may know how to email your family alert group, but does your spouse? During times of stress, skills that are practiced less often become harder to remember or steps get forgotten. Checklists take a little extra time, but can be an invaluable tool to ensure communications are still able to be sent during times of disaster. As you develop your emergency communication plan, considering the types of impacts from a disaster, downtime, types of communication methods available to you, and the training you provide to those in your team will greatly enhance your ability to communicate in disaster. In many cases, these four elements can be the difference in getting the message out and not being able to communicate when it matters the most. To receive upcoming articles on communication directly to your email, sign up for our newsletter here. All right, so just a good article of getting you to think about. I mean, it's heavy in the use of of cell phones. In reality, almost everybody uses cell phones. And so that, that does make sense to use that as your first line of communications. It's very possible that cellular towers are down and that kind of stuff is down. But that would be your go-to. Everybody's very familiar with that. But I think that having a procedure is going to be important, having some kind of process in place, having a closed group. I think that would be good in some way or fashion. If it's, Facebook, or if it is a Yahoo or a Google group, you can make those, really easy. I'm actually surprised Yahoo groups are still around. I thought they were closed down years ago, but maybe they're not. They're still around. But you can do that as well. So you send to one email address and it sends to everybody that's in that group. And that's how those work. I think it's important to think about what kind of communicate, and not just communicating with family and friends, because if it's the big one, right? The real big one, you're going to want to try to get information in. I mean, can you imagine being in a situation where things are going to crap, right? But you don't know how bad, you don't know what it's like out there. You don't know, and so you're always wondering. And so you're looking for someone to give you a little bit of information, I think it would be good to have, shortwave radios in your supplies. I think that's a good deal there. Having other means, ham radios, and then with survival antenna advertises with Prepper website, and it's just an antenna you can throw over a big 50-foot antenna. You can throw over a tree. It's very portable. You can roll it up and put it in your bag, and you can throw it over a tree, and you can connect it to your Baofeng, and greatly increases the range. Then you can also have something that increases the power as well on something like that. But I think you would want to have a means of finding information as much as possible. And so, I challenge you to look into that a little bit and think that through. All right. So that's talonsurvival.com. Our next article comes to us from the Economic Collapse blog. And many of you are familiar with Michael Schneider. He talks a lot about finances and where we are in the United States, and then also in the world economy, just with finances and a bunch of other things as well. This is not a very long article, so just hang tight. We'll start reading this one right here. Again, this one's called, "Is This the Generation That Is Going to Financially Destroy America?" Did you know that the federal government is going to spend more than $4 trillion this year? To put that into perspective, U.S. GDP for the entire year of 2017 is going to be somewhere between $18 and $19 trillion. So when you are talking about $4 trillion, you are talking about a huge chunk of our economy. But of course, the federal government doesn't bring in $4 trillion a year. At the beginning of Barack Obama's first term, we were $10.6 trillion in debt, and now we are nearly $20 trillion in debt. That means that we have been adding more than $1 trillion a year to the national debt. When you break that down, that means that we have essentially been stealing more than $100 million from future generations of Americans every single hour of every single day to pay for our debt-fueled lifestyle. Even Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen is warning that this is not sustainable, and yet we just keep on doing it. Nobody can pretend that what we have today is the kind of limited federal government that our founders intended. When federal spending accounts for more than 20% of GDP, it is hard to argue that we haven't moved very far down the road towards socialism. As I mentioned above, total federal spending will surpass $4 trillion for the first time ever in 2017. Quote, "Both the Congressional Budget Office and the White House Office of Management and Budget project that federal spending will top $4 trillion for the first time in fiscal 2017, which began on October 1, 2016, and will end on September 30th. In this update to the Budget and Economic Outlook 2017 to 2027, published last week, CBO projected that total federal spending in fiscal 2017 will hit $4 trillion, $8 billion, end quote. I was recently asked how we are going to pay for a $4 trillion government if we abolish the income tax like I am proposing. Well, the truth is that we would have to dramatically reduce the size and scope of the federal government. Our founders always intended for the individual state government to be much stronger than they are right now, and it is time for us to restore the constitutional balance. Something desperately needs to be done, because we have a federal government that is completely and totally out of control. Even the Congressional Budget Office agrees that we are headed towards absolute disaster if our leaders in Washington don't start displaying some fiscal responsibility. Quote, a large and continuously growing federal debt would increase the chance of a fiscal crisis in the United States. Specifically, investors might become less willing to finance federal borrowing unless they were compensated with high returns. If so, interest rates on federal debt would rise abruptly, dramatically increasing the cost of government borrowing. That increase would reduce the market value of outstanding government securities, and investors could lose money. The resulting loss for mutual funds, pension funds, insurance companies, banks, and other holders of government debt might be large enough to cause some financial institutions to fail, creating a fiscal crisis. An additional result would be a higher cost for private sector borrowing because uncertainty about the government's response could reduce confidence in the viability of private sector enterprises. It is impossible for anyone to accurately predict whether or when such a fiscal crisis might occur in the United States. In particular, the debt-to-GDP ratio has no identifiable tipping point to indicate that a crisis is likely or imminent. All else being equal, however, the larger a government's debt, the greater the risk of a fiscal crisis. The likelihood of such a crisis also depends on conditions in the economy. If investors expect continued growth, they are generally less concerned about the government's debt burden. Conversely, substantial debt can reinforce more generalized concerns about an economy. Thus, fiscal crisis around the world often has begun during recessions and in turn have exacerbated them. End quote. I get so frustrated with Republicans in Congress because they are supposed to be watching out for us. During the 2010 elections, one of the biggest midterm landslides of all time gave Republicans control of the House of Representatives, and they have had it ever since. One of the pillars of the Tea Party Revolution was fiscal responsibility, but the national debt has just continued to explode. When the Republicans took control of the House in early 2011, we were about $14 trillion in debt, and now we are nearly $20 trillion in debt. We have been betrayed, and those that have done this to us need to be held accountable. Of course, the biggest reason why our politicians never want to control spending is because they know what it will do to our economy. During the Obama years, we spent more than $9 trillion that we didn't have. If we could somehow go back and take $9 trillion out of the economy over those 8 years, we would be in the worst depression in U.S. history right now. Nobody in Washington wants to be responsible for plunging us into an economic depression, and so they just keep stealing from the future in order to prop things up in the short term. And a similar thing could be said about central bank intervention. If the Federal Reserve and other global central banks had not pumped trillions upon trillions of dollars into the financial system over the past 8 years, we would be in the midst of a horrific economic nightmare right now. But now, all of that hot money has created epic financial bubbles all over the planet, and when they finally burst, the ensuing crisis will be far, far worse than if they had never intervened in the first place. Global central banks now have more than $20 trillion in assets on their balance sheets, and the world is more than $217 trillion in debt. The desperate measures that national governments and central banks have been taking have delayed the coming crisis, but they have also guaranteed that it will be far worse than it could have otherwise been. The stage is set for the worst financial crisis in world history, and the only way that it can continue to be delayed is for our leaders to continue to inflate the bubbles larger and larger and larger. But of course, no bubble can last forever, and the bigger they become, the harder they burst. So, of course, over at Economic Collapse blog, there's a lot of comments there. Some people just spouting off and not really adding to the conversation, but there are other comments there. Economic collapse is one of the first things that I started looking at when I was started into preparedness, and I hit Michael's blog, early on. One thing to consider about Michael's post is that he always, you know, links back. He's not just giving his opinion. He's linking back to sources usually. Some people call him a fearmonger because he's always doom. Now, there are some things where, like, hey, it can be really, really bad. And he's talked about those. Hey, you know, be on the lookout right here, you know, this month or whatever. And, you know, people, I remember seeing I think I talked about it recently. Saw a message on his Facebook. Somebody left a message and said, like, hey, when is it going to happen? Like, you say it's going to happen because, you know, I'm like a laughing stock. I invested a lot of, you know, money in food, and people are making fun of me because nothing's happened. But it's going to happen. I mean, it's just the way it is. And going back to the politics of it all, you know, I think the Republicans have shown it. I mean, if you're not one of those people that are just like all, oh, I'm Democrat, I'm sold out Democrat, no matter what they do, I'm a Democrat, or I'm a Republican, no matter what they do, I'm a Republican, I'm an elephant, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. If you're looking at what they're doing, I mean, they have control of everything. I mean, the Republicans can be doing anything they want right now, and why aren't they? You know, and it's crazy thinking, and the idea, and I think everyone knows that, is because, you know, they don't want to disrupt the status quo. They like the power that they have. They like the ability to continue things the way that they're going. You know, they're hoping that they can get out or keep it going till they get out, and so they won't be responsible for you know, the collapse of the greatest, you know, nation in the world, in the history of the world. So one reason why you should make sure that you are financially stable, one reason why you should you know, be paying off your debt. You shouldn't be going into any other debt that you don't need to be in right now. You want to make sure that you're thinking about other ways of streams of income that you can bring in. You know, I recently wrote that article on ways that, you know, you could start your own preparedness website. And, you know, that might be one way that you do it. You're not going to get rich. You know, the people that are working at it full time and this is their job, you know, it's, you know, they really, truly work hard. I mean, it is a job, you know, and you're completely on your own. But there are a lot of other things that you can do. You know, what do people say that you do well? And then, you know, start monetizing that, whatever that might be. And so I know that we've talked about that in the past, but there's something maybe you need to start thinking about. Turn off the stupid TV, turn off the idiot box, you know, start doing something productive. Start thinking about how you can make some money, whether it's making crafts, maybe, you know, whatever it might be. And so go from there. All right, so that's the Economic Collapse blog. You can always go. He has a lot of links embedded into his article, so you go check that one out. All right, our last article comes to us from favorite people in preparedness, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, and this article is Snake Bites in Austere Settings. And it's one of those things, man, that, you know, you think about snakes, and I'm like Indiana Jones. It's like, man, it had to be snakes. I know some people love snakes and they're good with snakes. And definitely when we go up to the country and we see, you know, like a black snake or whatever, I mean, it was like we leave them alone. We don't want to mess with them. We know that they eat mice and rats and those kinds of things. But definitely, I just don't. I've never liked snakes. Don't ever want to hold one. Don't ever want to, you know, be around one that, you know, that I don't have to be around. And but this is a situation that, you know, you think about it, you're out there and you're camping, or you're out there and you are in an SHTF situation and you need to gather some wood to make a fire to cook or whatever, to heat something up. And you start grabbing, you know, pieces of wood and stuff, and you turn over a log and what have you. And there's a snake. And so you want to know, you know, if you get bitten, was it a venomous snake, you know, and you want to make sure that you know what to do. So let's go ahead and read this one at doomandbloom.net, Snake Bites in Austere Settings. Off the grid, you will find yourself outdoors a lot, with activities like gathering wood for fuel, foraging, and hunting required to keep body and soul together. In warm weather, you just might find yourself face to face, or maybe face to ankle, with a snake. Most snakes aren't poisonous, but a few are, including some species common in North America. The term poisonous snake is probably incorrect, as venom venoms and poisons are not the same thing. Poisons are absorbed in the gut or through the skin, but venom must be injected into tissue or blood via fangs or a stinger. Interestingly, it is usually not dangerous to drink snake venom unless you have a cut or sore in your mouth. Having said that, please don't test this out at home. Venomous snakes' bites have a distinct appearance due to the hollow fangs at the front of the mouth. This differs from non-venomous snakes, which have a more uniform appearance. And so, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy do a great job of always providing graphics, and so you want to go check that out so you can see the bite pattern of a snake, a venomous snake, and just a regular snake, and you can help to identify any bites out there if you don't have the snake, there. All right, continuing on. Since snakes are most active during the summer, most bite injuries occur then. Not every bite from a venomous snake transmits toxins to the victim. However, indeed, 25 to 30% of these bites will be dry and show little or no ill effect. This could be due to the short duration of time the snake has its fangs in its victim, or whether the snake had bitten another animal shortly beforehand. Many other snake bites are only slightly envenomations and resolve without major interventions. In most cases, it is not hard to tell whether there's venom in the bite. Snake bites containing venom tend to cause a painful burning sensation almost immediately. Swelling at the site may begin as soon as 5 minutes afterwards and may travel up the affected area towards the body core. Venomous snakes in North America, pit vipers and elapids. The two to worry about in North America are the pit vipers and the elapids. Of these, the pit vipers are responsible for the grand majority of venomous bites in the United States. Pit vipers, like rattlesnakes and water moccasins, are identified by the presence of a heat-sensing pit organ between the eye and nostril on both sides of the head. They are perhaps more easily recognized by their triangular-shaped heads and slit-like eyes. Rattlesnakes will, of course, have rattles that make noise when they're threatened. Pit viper bites tend to cause bruising and blisters at the side of the wound. Numbness may be noted in the area bitten, or perhaps on the lips or face. Some victims describe a metallic or other strange taste in their mouth. Serious bites might cause spontaneous bleeding from the nose or gums, irregular heart rhythms, or difficulty breathing. The elapids include cobras and mambas, but the main North American representative is the colorful coral snake. Coral snakes appear very similar to their look-alike, the non-venomous king snake. They both have red, yellow, and black bands and are commonly confused with each other. The old saying goes, red touches yellow, kill a fellow, red touches black, venom it lacks. In other words, if the red band is next to the yellow band, it is a deadly coral snake. If the red band touches the black band, it's a non-venomous king snake. It should be noted that this old saying only applies to coral snakes in North America. Coral snake bites are neurotoxic and will cause mental and nerve issues such as twitching, confusion, and slurred speech. Later, nerve damage may cause difficulty with swallowing and breathing, followed by total paralysis. Luckily, only 73 coral snake bites were reported in the U.S. in 2013. An ounce of prevention, they say, is worth a pound of care. High-top boots and long pants are always a sound strategy when hiking in the wilderness. It's important to be aware of where you're putting your hands and feet. Be especially careful around areas where snakes might like to hide, such as hollow logs, under rocks, or in old shelters. Wearing sturdy work gloves would be a wise precaution if you can't avoid these places. If you let snakes know you're near, they tend to leave the area. Snakes have no outer ear, so treading heavily creates ground vibrations much more easily heard by them than, say, shouting. In warm weather, many snakes like to be active at night. This means that nocturnal outdoor activities are inadvisable without a good light source. The standard treatment for a venomous snake bite is antivenin, also called antivenom. Antivenin is an animal or human serum with antibodies capable of neutralizing a specific biological toxin. Any hospital will have it, but in survival scenarios, this product will be a scarce commodity. If there's no help coming, consider these steps. Keep the victim calm. Stress increases blood flow, thereby endangering the patient by speeding the venom into the system. Stop all movement of the injured extremity. movement transports the venom into the circulation faster, so you're best to keep the limb still. Clean the wound thoroughly to remove any venom that isn't deep in the wound. Remove rings and bracelets from an affected extremity. Swelling is likely to occur. Position the extremity slightly below the level of the heart. This slows the transport of venom. Wrap with clean, loose bandages further up the limb than usual. Pressure bandaging is thought to be helpful for lapid bites, but may be risky for pit viper bites, as it may cause tissue damage. In any case, keep the wrapping somewhat less tight than when dressing a sprained ankle. If it is too tight, the patient will reflexively move the limb and spread the venom around. Avoid tourniquets, which do more harm than good. Draw a circle around the affected area. As time progresses, you will see the area shrink if it improves or grow if it worsens. By the way, this is a good strategy to follow for any local reaction, infection, abscess, or hematoma. The limb should then be rested and perhaps immobilized with a splint or sling. The less movement there is, the better. Keep the patient on bed rest with the bite site slower than the heart for 24 to 48 hours. This strategy also works for bites from venomous lizards like the Gila monsters. It is no longer recommended to make an incision and try to suck out the venom with your mouth. The amount of venom removed is thought to be very little, and oral bacteria could introduce an infection. Snake bite kits are available for your backpack, but are out of favor with most wilderness medical professionals. The Sawyer extractor, a syringe with a suction cup, is modern and compact, but ineffective in eliminating more than a fraction of the venom. These methods fail mostly due to the spread at which the venom is absorbed. These methods fail mostly to the speed at which the venom is absorbed by the body. You may wonder why I haven't suggested antibiotics as a treatment for snake bite. Interestingly, snake bites don't cause infections as frequently as bites from cats, dogs, or humans. As such, antibiotics are used less often. A snake doesn't always slither away after it bites you. It's likely that it still has more venom that it can inject, so move out of its trajectory or abolish the threat in any way you can. To many, this entails killing the snake. Even severing the head from the body may not render it harmless. However, it can reflexively bite for a period of time. Elapids and pit vipers may respond differently to an encounter with a human. Coral snakes are not as aggressive as pit vipers and prefer fleeing to attacking. Once they bite you, however, they tend to hold on. Rattlesnakes prefer to bite and let go. Unlike elapids, though, pit vipers may be reluctant to relinquish their territory to you, so leave the area as soon as possible. Snakes can be dangerous, but they want to avoid you as much as you want to avoid them. Keep an eye out, wear decent gear, and both you and the snake will be the happier for it. All right, so good advice there from Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy on how to deal with snakes in an austere environment. And again, you want to go check out all the pictures there that they have in the graphics. And then the graphic, just looking at the one with the snake bites, I think is worth it. And so, like always, I'll link to it on PrepperWebsitePodcast.com or in the show notes. So if your podcast catcher gets the show notes, you can go directly to their website and go check that one out. Always interesting over there. Medical preparedness is something that I think everybody should definitely be looking into more and more. All right, so I'm looking at earthquake.usgs.gov, and there has not been another earthquake since I started the podcast, so that's good. I'm sure people are happy about that in these areas that it's been going off. All right, so that's it for the podcast. Hopefully, again, like I said, if you're listening to this earlier in the day on Tuesday, you'll come and be a part of that webinar. Be there, and I'm looking forward to hearing what Paul has to say and interacting with you. There will be a question and answer time there. So if you ever had a question about the sun oven, that'll be a good time to go ahead and drop it in there, and I'll be able to pass that along to Paul and let him answer that question. The sun oven is very powerful. There's a lot of things you can do with it. So, it'll be a good webinar, good information. All right, so that's it for the podcast. you get a chance, come by the website, drop me a line in one of the comments sections, or hit me up on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Hey, choose to live a more self-reliant life. Choose not to be so dependent on the government, grid, or the grind. Until tomorrow, stay prepped and aware. Peace.